You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Ho. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished UK fund manager Paul Jordan of Amati Global. So massive welcome, Paul.
Thank you very much, Paul. Great to be back with you again.
Yeah, well, we've obviously had lots of news over the past few months since we spoke, not least Trump's trade tariffs, all the disruption caused from it, ongoing wars in Ukraine, the Middle East, plus an absolute mountain of corporate updates. So putting all that together, what's your sort of outlook for UK equities, particularly your sort of sweet spot of small and mid caps going forward?
Yeah, let's start with the easy question, shall we? I mean, you're right. The things that are going on in the world over the past 6 months are kind of unbelievable. And you know, these are mountainous things that are happening. You know, hugely significant, and they do make the world a much less kind of predictable place than, you know, what we're used to, I suppose. And most of my career I've been dealing with, the world's always unpredictable and bad stuff happens, but right now the unpredictable nature of what's happening is pretty extraordinary. So giving forecasts or making predictions is probably a bit of a fool's errand. I mean, I think, you know, how should one orientate oneself as an investor in when things are so confusing, I suppose, is really maybe a sensible question to ask. And, you know, maybe it's my age and how long I've been doing this, but I kind of think in an uncertain world, you kind of hunker down and you stick to what you know, and you find dependable businesses to invest in. You're not going to be able to get the timing perfect. You've got to accept that. They might have some upsets, but in the long run, they're going to see you through a difficult period. And if you can find businesses of a high enough quality, then, you know, that is really what matters. And so in a way, it's just, I think this, what's called for is just a certain amount of sticking to our knitting and sticking to what we know. And you know, as we talk through various companies, you know, hopefully the recurring message is, you know, there are some great businesses on the UK stock market. Some of them have had a hard time. Some of them are going well. But the ones that have had a hard time are likely to come out of it. You get very beaten up in this market if you have a hard time. So there's some incredible value opportunities. The companies out there that are really proving they can still grow through this environment look very interesting. You've also got to pay more for them, but you get something very different. Yeah. And you get the prospects of a sort of more greater level of predictability. So predictability is very highly valued at time in such an uncertain world. But you know, it's the same old dilemma of, you know, do you pay up for stocks where you think you know what's going to happen, or do you pay a lot less for things where you're not quite sure what's going to happen? And it's as we talk through the companies, I think that's going to be a recurring theme.
Yeah. Well, you're pretty good at the old prediction game, though, Paul. 3.5 years ago, you were the only fund manager in the UK who said Russia was going to invade Ukraine. It happened. You made that prediction about, I don't know, a month and a half, 2 months when he was on the border, etc. So given what's happening this weekend and what's in Washington this week, I'm going to put you on the spot, okay? So it's either a yes or no. Will we get? Do you think we're going to get a peace resolution in the next few months in between Russia and Ukraine?
I don't think so. No, is my my answer. I mean, obviously, I'd love to see one more than any, you know, as much as anybody else.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think my original prediction 3.5 years ago. I can't believe that, by the way, that you said I was the only one who thought that was going
to
happen.
You were the only one. Everybody else, including myself, was just adamant that there's no chance he's going to go into Ukraine. But yeah, you were the only one who did.
I think I think in some ways the war only ends when Putin dies, whenever that is. You know, he's in his 70s, so we might be quite a long way away from it. You know, in a way, the worst of all worlds is an unsatisfactory ceasefire or a false peace agreement, which just means he recoups and then reinvades. And you know, possibly that's even worse. Mm. And you know, I think what's become a lot clearer over the last 3.5 years is that Russia is a serious threat to Europe. And you know, we have been massively complacent about our military spending. We've allowed huge dependency on the US to grow up. We have almost no independent military means. And this is a real moment of real weakness. And you know, it will be addressed, but will it be addressed quickly enough?
Yeah.
And you know, when we come back to this growth versus value dilemma, one of the strongest themes out there over the next 10 years is clearly going to be defense spending. Mm. It doesn't make it an easy theme to invest in. It's incredibly difficult because it's so rapidly changing. But sadly, you know, we are in a world at war right now. That's the key difference between now and 4 years ago.
Yeah.
I can't really see that changing because Putin has dug in so deep. It's going to become such a personal mission. And we know that, you know, virtually everything he says is false. So we're going to trust anything that comes out of this. And the relationship between Trump and Putin is kind of inexplicable from the known facts. So there are clearly things we don't know, and it's all a bit of a mystery. So yeah, I think my gut feel is probably, I'm not expecting peace to break out, much as I'd love it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a great segue anyway into a couple of defense stocks you do own. Let's start with Chemring, which is sort of like really famous for the flares that it puts off helicopters, plus obviously energetics and things which go a bit bang. Plus, it's got rote cybersecurity. The shares have done brilliantly. In fact, I think they're trading at around about 27 times PE. So I guess the question is that, do you just run this winner or do you at some point sort of top slice? How are you viewing the defense sector? I can probably guess depending on what you've just said.
Yeah, I think I think the answer is we run them because this is a 10-year theme. It's complicated, and the key risk that you run with stocks like this is short-term earnings disappointments. Mm. But you're not going to get long-term earnings disappointments with I think any company in this sector really. You know, last year was very difficult because the government was conducting a defense spending review, as we all know. And that put things on hold. So you had this massive theme opening up, investment theme, but you also knew short-term it was very unpredictable and there were likely to be some disappointments. As it turned out, you know, the sector's muddled through that pretty well and it's re-rated very significantly upwards. But you know, the kinds of things that Chemring has are just, you know, I suppose, classic defense quality, really. And in particular, well, when I first started looking, it was a colleague of mine who sort of switched us onto it and said, oh, this looks really interesting. And I was just doing a review of the accounts. And, you know, the thing that jumps out at you first straight away is the incredible book-to-bill ratio in the company. And that's what you'd expect of long-term spending budgets just ratcheting upwards. And, you know, in the more recent set of accounts too, I think the book-to-bill ratio went over 2x. And so, you know, this is why you want to run these kind of companies because the stock market is pretty good at discounting next year's earnings. It's very bad at discounting earnings in 5 years' time, let alone 10 years' time. So if you've got what you think is a really good long-term growth trajectory, and you know, we're not talking about technology-type growth in one sense, and it's going to be like 10 times bigger in 5 years' time. It's not that kind of growth trajectory, but just very steady, substantial, significant growth. And Chemring is one of the few really pure play defense technology companies on the UK stock market. And so you've got to ask, really, how long is this company going to remain independent?
Yeah.
And clearly it was. There was a kind of prospect of a cheeky bid really last December. Thank goodness that didn't materialize. I think the rumors were it was Bain Capital, private equity, got interested in it. I mean, I think we'd have been very strongly opposed to selling this company back then, and I'm glad it didn't happen. And you know, if people are interested in it, look at what they're doing in Norway. A lot of funding from the Norwegian government to build a new energetics plant, you know, which will be energetics, by the way, it's an easy term to say. It sounds like it might be kind of Lucozade or something like that. You know, this is very high explosive material.
Yeah.
It's effectively rocket fuel, amongst other things. And I remember doing a site visit to Cameron's plant in Scotland years and years ago. And, you know, it was on an old airfield or something. It was these scattered little industrial huts on a very big site. And the reason it had to be like that is just every now and then these things blow up and you're trying to extrude this rocket fuel into some kind of projectile.
Yeah.
And you've got to, you know, compress it, push it in. It's like, they look like candles, actually. But they're candles. If you want to light them, if you light the fuse on this candle, it's kind of burns in under a second. And, you know, they you might say, well, that's quite basic, but actually the know-how and just the industrial know-how and safety requirements and the, I think the barriers to entry are pretty substantial, really, in that kind of business.
Yeah. Yeah, the certification to be able to supply those into the military. I mean, you can't just rock up there and decide, okay, right, I'm going to have my own explosive factory, that's for sure.
No. And we might have also have a why on earth do we need these things? I mean, clearly it didn't look like we did 10 years ago, but now it's obvious. And of course, the other side of their business, Roke, is super interesting as well.
Yeah.
And it gets you into drones and AI and, you know, high cyber intelligence, electronic warfare, all those kind of things, which we also know from what's going on in Ukraine, you know, that is how important those areas are and how rapidly moving they are.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think their strategic aim is to double revenues over the next 5 years to get about $1 billion. I think they're running at about $540 million at the moment. Yeah. I mean, if they do that, the 27 times is going to look very, very cheap in 5 years' time.
Sure. So. I'd be very surprised if they don't do that.
Yeah. Okay, another one in that sector. We've got Kinetic, which does more sort of like services into the MOD, into the military, sort of robotics and stuff like training and all this sort of stuff. I think it had a bit of a blip at the end of last year from the Strategic Defence Review because short cycle defence contracts were being pushed to the right. Shares, though, have recovered very strongly since then. What's your like? Is it the same sort of thing on this one?
It is. It's slightly different, only in the sense that this one came out of the MOD, of the MOD's research department. So there is a golden share. It's not going to be taken over. They made an expansion into the US, which didn't go as well as they'd have liked, but in the long run is clearly the right thing to do. But if you look at their businesses, you know, they're going to be lower margin than something like Chemring because it's a more regulated kind of margin that they have. It's always going to be like 10% operating margin. But it's also got just massive barriers to entry and demand for that service is going to be increasing. So it's just very solid and well-placed in the defense business. And again, you know, like Chemring, it's really well set to grow over the next 5-10 years. And it's a long-term growth story, really, I'd say.
Yeah, it's only on a 16 times PE compared to 27, so it's a bit cheaper. If anybody wants to ask Paul any questions, please put them into the chat box and I will read them out. We've got one from Joe Viateski. He's asking about the marine oil and gas services company, Ashtead Technologies, that was a bit of a darling, I think, not long ago. The shares have come off as all oil and gas and renewable services businesses. What's your sort of your latest on this one? Is this a buying opportunity?
I think the answer is yes, it is. I mean, this is a fabulous business. Very well placed long term. You're absolutely right, it was a complete darling. AIM stock had everything going for it, which has got very well rated and justifiably so. And then actually the biggest sort of dampener on it is a short term factor, really. They had a revenue warning, which was very unexpected at the last set of results. And they'd sort of been kind of telling everybody that the oil price being low wasn't a problem and that the US business was going to be okay. And they had a lot of confidence, and then suddenly there was, you know, there was a revenue downgrade. Interestingly, not really much of a profit downgrade this year. But you know, the way these things work is the forecast is going to get rolled forwards, and there is more of an impact. But you know, this is a very solid, a very well respected company, and they have made the decision. And this is a kind of something we'll talk. It's worth highlighting this because yeah. They made the decision they want to move to the full list, and a lot of their shareholders, including us, don't agree that this will add any value to the business at all. We just don't see why they want to do it, and that's a quite a significant cost to doing it. It takes management time. It also
just for investors, this is a 260 million market cap company, isn't it?
Yeah. So it won't be in the mid 250 for some time to come. We just don't see that it's worth doing. But you know, they've set up their stall, and we've spoken to senior management about it, and they're just completely adamant their mind's not going to change, that this is what they want to do. And so, you know, that while that you can kind of just about do that when you've got to change your shareholder base pretty substantially, the IHT funds, which we run a small one, need to sell out before you do it, and then you rely on other buyers coming in to replace them. And in every company that's done it, it's been a bit bumpy. You know, it's quite a few have done it satisfactorily, but it's a pretty horrible thing to do to your IHT portfolio shareholders because they tend to have to sell at not a great time. And that's depressed the rating. So they went into this revenue downgrade with already having put the shares under a lot of pressure through just announcing they wanted to move the listing. So it's quite technical. It's really nothing to do with the company's trading that. But right now, that's put the shares under a lot of pressure. So you know, if you can afford to look through that, then yeah, I think this is a very interesting moment to be buying it. I do think the business quality is absolutely there, and will come through in not very much into the medium term. It's just, you know, that this year hasn't gone as well as they hoped. There's actually a couple of big customers delaying some projects, and you know, but they're not going to be cancelled. So you know, I think the business remains on a growth trajectory, and it's absolutely not rated for that. But you kind of need this move to the full list issue to be sorted out. But that will happen in the next few months.
Yeah. Do you know, I mean, they've got the valuation, they're trading on an incredibly low 7.5x PE. Yeah. But do you know why for an oil and gas company they hardly pay a dividend, actually? It's a very low dividend.
Well, it's a rental business. So they don't produce oil and gas. They're selling kind of key bits of kit they're renting key bits of kit that the big oil services company use for particular jobs, don't want to own themselves on the whole. And the barrier to entry for them is that they're not just renting the kit. They are renting a service, and they give advice, and if you go to Ashtead Tech, they'll really help you get the job done. And you know, these are relatively small parts of the overall CapEx. So if a project gets a bit delayed, that can temporarily hit their revenue. But you know, if you follow what's going on in oil and gas, a big new discovery is around. Is this all the offshore oil and gas industry? And there's a lot of work going on. And even with the low oil price, the prospects are quite buoyant. I'd say if the oil price goes below $60, that does become an issue for them. So we're not that far away from it. But the reason they're not paying much of a dividend is because they want to invest in growth. So buying more kit, actually, it's capital.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, let's just stay in that oil and gas sector. We've got North Sea Oil and Gas Explorer at Serica Energy, who's adopting the same policy, which I'm sure is getting your wrath as well, that they're going from AIM onto the main market, aren't they? They're basically look for older fields and improve the recovery rates, and they've had a very good track record of doing that. I think they've had a bit of maintenance issues on some of this old sort of stuff in their Titan field or something, or Triton field, is it? But how are you seeing now? The shares have actually recovered quite well, even though the oil price has gone down, which is just like counterintuitive.
Well, so first of all, Serica's got a little bit more of an argument for moving to the full list, and it doesn't really have any IHT portfolio investors.
Right.
Strangely, actually, because you'd have thought it would have been a good candidate. But I think one of the reasons a few years ago, it just had a lot of cash. If you have a lot of cash, then that starts to become harder for those portfolios to hold you. And also it's very volatile, it's commodity price dependent. But actually the last couple of years, Serica's share price has really been a function of the tax regime in the UK more than the oil price, interestingly. And that's why it's gone up despite the oil price going down, is because the prospects of some kind of sensible end point to this very silly EPL tax regime that the UK yeah. has arriving is being a little bit, there's a bit more optimism in the industry that there will be some kind of resolution to what has been a massive set of policy blunders, effectively, and started by the Conservatives, made worse by the current government. Just incredibly little understanding of the importance, just the strategic importance of the UK oil and gas industry. And for people who really sort of follow the energy markets quite closely, this has just always looked just like such a massive own goal to try and destabilize and destroy the UK's oil and gas industry, which does nothing for our green credentials, does nothing to reduce our emissions. In fact, just puts them up. And you know, maybe it doesn't under some crazy account, the carbon accounting mechanisms, but you know, most people have no interest in those. The fact is, it puts up our carbon emissions. It also, more importantly, it means we're just much more likely to end up buying oil and gas from dictators, whether it was Russia or Middle Eastern sources or regimes which are not favourable towards the UK. Yeah. And it's just a massive weakness. And so there's a bit more hope that sense is going to prevail. And actually, the fact that the UK government really needs more revenue and tax revenue, perversely, means they're more likely to come up with a sensible solution to the EPL, which actually is a revenue destroyer for government. Yes. Because it's going to shut down the industry really fast. And that's massively costly for the UK taxpayer. Yeah. I think very few people understand. It seems so counterintuitive, but actually it's huge. This is value destruction all over. And this was a really significant UK business, UK industry, the Aberdeen-based oil and gas industry. So, the fact the share price has risen means that any kind of sensible resolution to the EPL policy mechanism, and actually just, I might as well explain what's going to happen. They're consulting on what should it look like post-2030. And once they've decided how it should look like post-2030, then there's going to be a very strong argument to say, well, the oil price is really low. The gas price is nowhere near what it was. It's relatively lowish now. Why are we waiting to 2030 to rescue this industry? Yeah. Why don't we just, because what will happen is if you wait till 2030, every bit of CapEx goes on hold. And that's, again, very bad for the government and for the UK. So you can see the logic. So maybe it gets brought forwards and that would be incredibly good for Serica and all of the North Sea gas producers, and they could start spending money in the North Sea again, and that's what they would do.
Yeah. And is the dividend sort of sustainable? I mean, they're on 7x PE, but I've got a dividend of sort of like double digits, so sort of like 10% or so.
Yeah, it has a very strong balance sheet. And if it's not going to spend CapEx in the UK, which right now it's not, then they can pay out the money.
Brilliant. Okay, well, let's just move to another one in that sector. We've got a PetroTal, which I've never, ever, ever covered before. It basically is a Peruvian oil and gas producer. I don't know how you've ever found this one anyway. I didn't even know it was listed, but it basically trades on, it's got sort of like, low double-digit dividend return.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very niche stock, and it's until for quite a long time been a single asset company in Peru, and it's had all the ups and downs of the Peruvian political windmill, for want of a better term. But the thing that attracted to me, I came across it quite a number of years ago, and the thing that attracted to me about it was just what an incredible asset the company has.
Yeah.
And this was one of the cheapest things I'd ever seen in the sector when I came across it. A phenomenal asset, highly productive, well managed. They had, had a lot of issues to negotiate over the time, not the least of which was how to capture really a good social license to operate. And they operate in an environmentally quite sensitive area, and they have to be very careful about that. And they have been, and they pay a lot of money to central government. And one of their issues was that none of that money came back to the local communities. So they actually had to invent a way of building in a royalty from what they do that goes to the local communities. And since they've done that, that's improved their operations a lot. They've got issues with export routes, and they've been incredibly effective at coming up with ways of addressing the challenges. For people who want to look into it, I won't bore you with all the details, but I think I'd say that that's improved massively. They are expanding the asset into adjacent areas. They bought a new asset recently, which is very promising. So it's basically just a really significant little oil producer
Yeah.
So, you know, it has some issues, but it has massive cash flow, and that's why it pays a high yield. And I just think it's an interesting, and actually yeah. made very good money out of it since we've invested in it, which isn't true of everything in this sector. So it's been good, but it's pretty niche and a little bit of a backwater stock.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. I mean, well, I know it's listed on the state in Toronto as well, but it's sort of $450 million market cap. So, you know, it's a decent size, no doubt about it. Yeah. Okay, we've got Lemon Physical, just move sectors into the technologies, asking about a company that's been in the news a lot, Big Technologies. They're famous for the electronic tagging of prisoners around the world. They've got a big position, I think, in Australasia, and they've got they're moving into the States as well and in Europe and stuff, and lots of very good long-term contracts, excellent margins, strong balance sheet. However, could you give us your latest views on how you view this business? The shares have dropped, obviously, because of the litigation risk.
Yes, I think, where do we start? We start. I mean, the most important place to start with this company is that there is a fabulous business in here.
Yeah.
And they have the best technology in the world for prisoner tagging. I find it a complete mystery, really, why governments, and in particular our government, because that's what I know about, doesn't make massively more use of tagging than it does. And actually, I suspect the reason is because they're buying the wrong tags. They're just buying ones that don't work.
Yes.
And have all kinds of problems and can be just cut off with a pair of scissors. Whatever,
it's G4S in the UK, isn't it? G4S, yeah, Serco Capita.
I mean, they have a bad reputation. I haven't actually seen their tags, but I know that the Home Secretary got incredibly cross with them very soon after that appointment started. You know, what this is actually, there's a big lesson to learn here, and this actually deserves a lot more examination. Why did we end up buying the wrong tags from the wrong company? Because actually, if we had the right ones now, you'd be able to have far fewer people in prison. And actually, the big tech tags, one thing that really interests me about them is they can also do alcohol monitoring really effectively. And, you know, you think about the how much domestic abuse comes from alcohol problems. If you could let somebody go, you know, part of your punishment, if you like, could be that you're not allowed to drink. And here's a tag that can notify the authorities as soon as you do. I mean, the uses of that, it just jumps out at me. You know, this just seems, as a kind of, you know, total layman in this field, I can't understand why these things aren't massively more used in our country. But, you know,
I'd love to take that tag down the pub, I tell you, and have a few bargees and see how high we could push it. That'd be fabulous fun.
Yeah, and, you know, you could have people staying in jobs rather than going to prison, but wearing a tag and having that, you could still have an effective punishment, which is an alternative to prison. And these tags open up that possibility. And surely in the 21st century, you know, we're still using prisons for Victorian establishments. And in so many ways, they're massively out of date and very problematic. And, you know, we know the condition of the estate is terrible in the UK and so on. So anyway, it's a global business and they've got a lot of very promising opportunities. They have very high recurring revenues. It's about the long process of getting into government procurements around the world. So, you know, we think it's inherently a high quality company. Obviously, it's had every kind of management issue that you could have had, and that's why the share price is incredibly low. So, really, this is an option on that being sorted out, and you've got to take a view on new management. What's going to happen with the litigation? The company has something like 90 or 100 million pounds on its balance sheet. So it's an incredibly strong position. I think it was about to acquire a US company just before all this latest round kicked off. And it's a very good job it didn't do that, because it's just meant that, you know, there are no questions over the survivability of this company. So it's a classic kind of recovery situation. How does it find its way back to a situation where it can grow and the value of the underlying business can be recognized?
Yeah. And just in terms of that litigation, just indicatively, how much time do you think that's going to take? And any views on what the outcome might be? It was sort of like the word on the street is that it will probably be an out of court settlement. But hey, you know, I don't know.
Probably, because these things normally are. That's what it should be. But I don't have any extra insights into that over what's in the public domain.
I think the reason why the UK government originally decided to go with someone else, because they insisted on owning the IP. And I think big technologies refuse to sell their IP to the government because they were using it elsewhere for other customers, which is not unreasonable.
I also heard that it's because they hired a management consultant to do the procurement. Very bad start. The management consultant said, we're going to separate out the monitoring from the tags. But the whole point about big techs is you save a huge amount of money because you don't need anywhere near the amount of monitoring over fixing problems because they don't break and they get cut off. Yeah. And you know, really, they should have put it all into one thing. So big tech actually couldn't prove how much money they were going to save because they just said, well, anything you can save on the monitoring and the servicing, we're going to ignore that. Yeah. And that put them in an impossible position from the word go.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move. Still stay in the IT sector. Let's move to Kainos. We've got Phil who's asking about it. Basically, it's sort of like a IT software implementer and solutions provider. Got a big practice in Workday software, largely into the UK corporate sector and public sector, but also a bit overseas. The shares obviously have struggled a bit of late as people have deferred big ticket sort of like digitization contracts. But how do you see this one? It's trading at about 17 times PE, but the balance sheet looks really strong.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, I love this company. And I think it's one where you have to disaggregate it a bit. And as is well known, there's a software business in here, a pure software company that has annual recurring revenue. Can't remember what the last figure was, 50, 60 million. It's one of the fastest growing software companies listed in the UK, actually. And you look at the growth trajectory of that, it's kind of eye-watering. And most software businesses would die for the kind of qualities that Kainos' software business has. And this is selling effectively add-on bits of software to the Workday platform. And the Workday platform is hugely successful. And they're in a very privileged position amongst providers of having a close relationship with Workday. Workday let them know where there are kind of gaps in the software, extra functions that are desired, but they don't want to build themselves. And Kainos can add on modules to do that. And so that, you know, there's other things we can talk about around that, but I won't go into that now, it'll take too long. But basically very high quality software business, very rapidly growing. What's that worth? And you add on, that with the cash, you're really not paying a whole lot for the rest of the business. The rest of the business is consultancy, and there's a big Workday consultancy implementation franchise, and that Workday's growth has slowed down a bit. So, and they've introduced more service companies. So the growth trajectory of that business has slowed and it became a bit less interesting. But nonetheless, it's a very solid business. They're a very respected provider. And this is one thing we should come back to a lot with Kainos. Is the work they do is just incredibly high quality. It's, you know, it's one of the most in their niches. They're just very, very highly respected. And then there's the UK consultancy business where they're taking on projects mainly for government, but also they try to get a corporate business going, and that's been a bit slow. And you know, they probably need to have been addressing some management issues around that, because really Kainos should have a very good corporate business as well. But the government side of this slowed down hugely with the government spending reviews, and we should start to see that reaccelerate over the coming year. So I'm a lot more optimistic about that. If you want to know the kind of thing they do, you know, I look at the DVLA website, and actually I just renewed my driving license today, and it was actually a joy because the technology is just brilliant. And you know, that's kind of, you know, when you kind of think, well, actually government should be digitizing this stuff, they have done it in certain areas really effectively, and Kainos just does very high quality work in that, in those kind of areas. So, you know, and they do a lot of the health service, and they're kind of broad coverage of government. And then the corporate side of it, if you think about it, what's going to happen with AI globally? Well, corporates are going to adopt it over the next 5-10 years. And companies like Kainos, I think, are going to be very instrumental in helping them do it. And that's all a bit vague and woolly, but, you know, as a kind of big picture investment theme, we should start to see that pay off. I mean, that's not a short-term thought. That's a longer-term thought about Kainos, but it's another reason why this is quite an interesting business.
Yeah, and I'm guessing AI, it will be a tailwind to that software business, will it, in terms of, because, well, you know, if you had Workday putting agentic chatbots or agentic agents onto its software, would it replace some of the software or customization that Kainos has done for clients?
I don't think anytime soon.
Yeah.
Because it's not reliable enough. And yeah, you build these corporate systems to have incredibly high reliability, and you've got to have facts that come out of it you absolutely know are right. I don't think that, but the more immediate threat is just AI's use in programming. So then do you need fewer consultants? See a lot of businesses like Kainos start to reduce their staff bases, and Kainos have done that. Others around the world and similar kind of companies are doing it too. Yeah. And that's probably the right thing to do. And certainly with the unpredictability around. But that remains to be seen. But that was one of the kind of sort of bare points about Kainos. So it's all going to be replaced by AI. That's not going to happen. But then maybe you need fewer consultants. Maybe that means your turnover goes down. But actually your demand at some point, there's a bit of a surge in demand. And really, if you can get more done for less, then probably the same amount of money gets spent. You're just getting more done.
Yeah.
And actually, it could increase the barriers to entry for a company like Kainos.
No, it's a fabulous point made there in terms of AI, perhaps replacing some of the consultants, because you've seen that with FDM, which is a sort of lower level IT implementation and consultants, and they've been impacted. Okay, let's stay in the tech scene. We've got Tony is asking about Trainline, how to catch a train, and the shares obviously have been under a bit. The track has gone down, unfortunately, of late, as the government has sort of inferred that it's going to set up its own train ticketing website. Plus, there's been contracts with extending the tap and go system around the country into regional cities and stuff. How do you see this one? They're trading at very reasonable valuation the last time.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the cheapest it's traded ever since I've known it. And ever since I first met this company, which was when it was still private, I've always thought, wow, this is just an incredible business. But it's not a simple, not necessarily a simple business, but, so let's talk about the key attributes of Trainline. It's the number one provider. So, it's the ticketing system that everybody has in their pocket, basically. And even if we don't all of us use it for every ticket we buy, then you're using it a lot if you're traveling much around the UK and you can be walking to the station, you're just 100 yards away, you buy your ticket on your phone, you flash it on the reader as you go through. And that's incredible when you think about it. But you used to have to kind of get there a quarter of an hour early because you might have to queue for an unspecified period of time just to buy your ticket. So actually the world has really moved on, and Trainline has been massive in helping that happen. But being the number one is what matters here. And they are totally the dominant provider in the UK. Yes, you can buy your tickets in other ways, but it's rare that most of us do that. The growth story with it really is about Europe. And Trainline has this incredible opportunity to become the number one across Europe. And, probably an aggregated market share already is. But then you've got certain monopolies like the Deutsche Bahn monopoly in Germany that the state don't want to give up. France has been difficult because it tends to be a little bit state monopolistic. Spain and Italy have made much, much more progress. Spain's really opening up. And so, that carrot of just have one app, it'll take you wherever you want to go by train. I've actually got to do a couple of trips in Germany later in September by train, and I'm going to buy my tickets on Trainline because last time it took me hours of research and going onto the Deutsche Bahn website and trying to, make sure I'd understood the German. Now I'm looking forward to just being able to buy the ticket on Trainline and have all of that removed. And so, the clear benefit of having a single app that does the whole of Europe is huge. But as ever, the UK, we seem to have a kind of death wish for companies when we're building real leading businesses of significance. We have a site, always the temptation there to undermine them. And actually, I think the thing that's going on with the UK government is over the split ticketing business, where Trainline, having phenomenal technology, figured out split ticketing, made it available to everybody before anybody else. And the government kind of probably hates them for that because it's shown up a real weakness in the underlying pricing proposition for UK. Why is it that if you buy two single tickets, it's cheaper than buying the whole journey? That's just kind of crazy. But this is about civil servants more than it's about government. And so many things about policy are actually about civil servants, not the politicians. We always blame the politicians, but we forget the civil servants are the ones who carry on and have the year-long, decade-long relationships. So I think there's some civil servants who just don't like Trainline. But it would be crazy to try and replace it completely, or to try and aggressively replace it with a government-owned system. Obviously, the government wants its own system. That's fair enough. But they're going to have to recognise that people tend to stick to what they know. And having such a strong brand as Trainline, it's very hard to see that being really displaced. And how much money is the government going to spend on building this? You know, Trainline's platform costs hundreds of millions. You know, it feels so simple, but the scalability and the simplicity of it is very deceptive. It's simple because it's extremely good and just very, very well set up and expensive. Yeah. So, you know, a lot went into creating that. Is it really right for the government to try and spend 100 million plus to build their own one? I don't know. So but it's a medium-term issue anyway. And in the short term, I think we should see continued, really, you know, really good continued growth. But that medium-term risk has always been there with Trainline. And there's always been these unpredictable, what's going to happen with GB Rail and, you know, nationalisation? How does this all play out? So you are just taking a view that actually the brand and the technical strength of Trainline is going to win through and give them a continued strong position post whatever happening.
Yeah. Do they do connecting tickets with sort of like, I don't know, flights or even Ubers and stuff? Because you see Uber trying to now muscle into this game.
They don't. And I suppose because there's no real need to do that. Yeah. They're such different things. If you try and mix chalk and cheese, it's, you know, people have got different apps for, you know, and it's interesting how much Uber spent on getting into the market. And the fact that they've got nowhere really reminds me of when Google tried to disrupt Rightmove's position in the UK property market and basically got nowhere.
Yeah, okay.
And so you have very big US tech companies coming in. It's easy to think, oh, no, they're such big names, they're going to just do it. But actually, it doesn't tend to work like that. So it's been extraordinary how little market share Uber has gained by very aggressive price promotional sort of entry procedure. Yeah. And I suppose one of the big differences, well, I don't know this for sure, but they certainly didn't used to have split ticketing. Mm. So why are you going to switch?
Yeah, good. Okay, we've got a couple of other people asking about, I'm not sure you own these shares, but Ben Sharma is asking about CT Automotive. And we've got BB asking about Harbour Energy. Any? Do you own those at all? Or
no? I don't own those, I don't know them really well enough to.
Yeah, no.
Harbour Energy, I'd say many of the same issues as Serica in respect of UK North Sea tanks.
Okay, good. I think they've got another one question. We've got David Raywood. He's asking about Greatland Resources, which is Greatland Gold, I think. Sort of miner out in Australia, I believe, if I remember rightly. Quite a big company. I think the shares have done pretty well. What's your sort of your latest in the precious metals ecosystem?
Well, okay, so as is well known, gold has had the most phenomenal price run. And so much so that, we have a mining fund, so I'm all the time talking to our mining guys about what's going on in the gold market, what's happening with the shares. And, you know, the fact is the gold shares have had a good run, but they're still not really believing the gold price. Mm. And is that right or wrong? I mean, you know, we can debate what happens with gold. I'm worried about mean reversion in the gold market. You look at the chart and you think, oh, that's going to have to come back to its averages at some point. On the other hand, it's really about China. And I think the really strong action in the gold market is driven by Chinese central bank wanting to decouple from its dependence on the US dollar. And is that about to change? Probably not. So actually there's a very strong fundamental behind the gold price move. Having said that, you know, eventually expect mean reversion. We just don't know when, but to a higher base. Greatland Gold, this was a company that discovered a big asset near a mine called the Telfer Mine in Western Australia. Mm. At the time, it was owned by Newcrest, and Newcrest farmed into it, spent a lot of money on exploring it. It's called Havieron. It's a really substantial new gold mine in waiting. And the idea was, instead of having to build a whole new plant, you could just truck the ore 40 kilometers or whatever it is to the Telfer mine and process it there using the Telfer production. So everyone kind of thought that Newcrest would eventually buy Greatland. And instead of buying it, it sold itself to Newmont, an even bigger gold company. And for Newmont, this was non-core. And what transpired was Newmont sold, first of all, Newcrest pulled out of their farming. So Greatland owned 100% of Havieron again. And then Newmont decided to sell the Telfer mine to Greatland. So it went from being an interesting explorer to being a really significant producer, owning a massive great mine and a load of production facilities near their new mine, which meant that they were now completely in control of it all. So this, you know, actually that's when I got really interested in it, because we like to buy producers rather than explorers, and suddenly this was a producer. So we did help fund that transaction for Greatland to buy out Newmont from the Telfer mine, and actually that proved to be a phenomenal acquisition. And the management team who run this are just very highly regarded in Australia, and they've done this before, and they built up substantial mines and then sold them. And that was the key attraction. The reason why the shares have come off quite a lot recently is a bit more complicated. So there's a lot of due diligence to do on this Telfer acquisition. And one of the assets they bought was a very large amount of stockpiled ore.
Yes.
Because the Telfer mine had stopped producing for a while because they had a problem with one of their tailings dams that had to be fixed and is now fixed. But it was fixed just about a month after this acquisition. So they're stockpiling, you know, just a very, very large amount of ore at surface, some high grade, some lower grade. And the higher grade material had been sampled at 50 meter intervals, and they produced an average grade, or what they thought was an average grade. And what happened most recently was that the management team had experienced a lower grade than they were expecting from this high grade stockpiled ore. And they now want to resample it at 25 meter intervals, and they put out a different range of expectations of what they think the grade's going to be. And that led short-term production to be expectations to be brought down, and the range of expectations has been widened. It's because clearly they don't know what the 25-meter sampling is going to show. So let's have a quick drink.
That's all right.
So, you know, and that unfortunately that happened about a month or two after an Australian ASX IPO. Because they re-domiciled to Australia, they wanted to get the big Australian institutions to buy in. And so the buyers at the IPO were kind of upset in Australia, not the buyers like us who funded the acquisition, because we're still actually making a huge amount of money out of this, but the IPO was quite well priced. And so it's in a temporary kind of, you know, lots of shareholders are not very pleased with it. But, you know, I think this management team is really top draw, and notwithstanding what's happened, and they are operationally superb. And very kind of prudent, and they do, you know, just incredible level of operational skill and diligence over what they're doing. And actually, they did exactly the right thing to come to the market and explain this as soon as they found out about it, rather than wait 6 months and then sort of say, oh, our production's a bit lower and it was all a bit more, you know, it's the right thing to do is tell the market about it as soon as you can. But actually, the more significant thing that they said at the same time is they're going to spend, I can't remember the exact amount, $150 million or something like that on exploration drilling at the Telfer mine, which is indicating that they're very confident they can extend the life of it significantly, you know, by, you know, maybe 2-3 years. So this mine has fantastic cash flow because it's a mature asset, fully depreciated. And if they can bring new more local ore into it, that's just very, very accretive very quickly.
Yeah.
And especially at the current gold price. So actually, you know, I think they've had a bit of a knock, explained why. I think the next things that happen with this should be a lot more positive. And we should start to see some drilling results come through from the local mine. They'll come up with the bankable feasibility study by the end of the year for Javier on. That will then cement the development plan. And, you know, this is already a significant producer, but it has a very short mine life right now. That will be extended locally at Telfer Mine, and then for 10 years plus, once Javier comes on stream. And beyond Javier, there's a lot more, there are a lot of exploration assets. So this is like a whole district gold mining company. I think it's one of the most interesting gold miners I've seen for a long time.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Just stay in that same sector. We've got Sarah. She's asking about Hochschild Mining, which I think is it a Peruvian gold and silver miner. I think they've had a couple of issues recently, but the shares, hey, they've done brilliantly, so it doesn't really matter.
Well, yes, I mean this has been a bumpy ride over the last few years. Yeah. They've recovered incredibly from the lows, but they, you know, they were £2 and then they fell right down.
Yes,
it was the Peruvian election, and they had a long period when they were waiting for their mining license at the Immaculada mine in Maquilado, which is a very high altitude mine in Peru in the Andes, got shut down by the government temporarily, or was threatening to be shut down, and there were threats over not renewing the license. And in the end, they got a 20-year renewal. So, you know, that came through, and that's really what caused the big recovery in the shares. And the Peruvian politics has all settled down anyway from the slightly crazy days of 2022. And they developed a new mine in Brazil called Mara Rosa. And that one, the thing that brought the shares down recently, that sort of latest fall, was having to shut that mine down for some production issues. It'll get restarted, but that created some uncertainty, really just cash flow uncertainty. The Immaculada mine's been producing very well, and that's a gold and silver mine. It's been around for decades, and it's one of those mines where it never has that long a mining life, but every time they go look for more resources, they've always found them. Mm. So with the current gold and silver price, it translates to, you know, very strong earnings for the company. The Mara Rosa should come back on stream. It's been a bit accident prone, I'd say, Hochschild. It's not as straightforward a story as Greatland, but it has silver in the mix, and the silver is a whole bull market all of its own. Yeah. You know, I gather from George and Mark, silver's pretty undersupplied, and, you know, a really interesting market in its own right. So for silver exposure, it's an interesting place to go.
Yeah, what's the geopolitical risk in Peru in terms of the, you know, the government? How stable is it? You'd think they'd want to encourage overseas investment into the business.
Yeah, they do. But every now and then they go through a phase when they don't, you know, like a developing country.
Feel like so British
2022, they went through that phase, and then you know, that president didn't last very long, and actually the lady who took over is much more sensible and understands that they need a mining industry, and then actually has done a lot to cultivate one. So it's all calmed down significantly, I'd say. Right now, feels okay.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's go back to the rail tech sector. We've got Alan. He's asking about Traxys, that again was a bit of a darling, and then unfortunately about 12 months, 18 months ago, started seeing a delay to CP7, I think it is, which is the rail transition. So some of their orders got, and then the US as that also started to quieten off a bit as well. But it basically does all things sort of software and technology into the UK rail and overseas rail. How do you see that one going for good, strong balance sheet?
Yeah, and this has now entered the territory of being a classic kind of recovery stock, potentially.
Yeah.
I mean, it had a perfect storm, CP7. Yeah. I mean, there was this extraordinary situation when they announced a 5-year rail budget, and this affected some other companies too. And then what I gathered was the civil servants forgot to factor inflation into the budget. And so they realized they didn't have enough money for the 5 years. So they just said, okay, well, we can solve this easily. We just won't spend anything in year one. It's kind of almost comical. But for the industry, a total, total disaster. I mean, you know, this is such a bad way to treat your private sector suppliers. You know, I think the civil servants have no idea about the mayhem that causes. So that affected Renew a bit as well, and Traxys. It's quite well publicized. You know, I think by that's coming to the end, and by next year we should see. You know, we have to spend on the rail, right? This can't just be, it's a non-optional spending. So we should start to see that come back. And then actually, the last set of results, Traxys talked about one of their customers having a cyber attack and meant they couldn't do ordering that they needed to do. So that was another element that went wrong. And then the US has also been too slow, and we haven't yet seen the evidence that that's really going to get where it needs to get. So in a way, it's a perfect storm. They've got a new CEO come in, and this is really about, well, what can the company get itself back to where it was? If it does anything like that, then actually there's a lot of value to be recaptured in this business.
Yeah, there's also that headwind from the government putting Great British Railways together, which has sort of stopped a lot of train operators from actually spending because they've got no incentive because they're going to have to hand the keys back in a couple of months. I mean.
Well, that's true. And then hidden within Traxys, there is this pay-as-you-go system, which is, you know, they built the plumbing for it. So they're not, you know, train
this is the, and others. This is the tap-and-go ticketing.
Tap-and-go. You know, they don't have the whole solution, or not the best version of the whole solution. But they built the plumbing to enable it, which means that companies like Trainline or whatever the government comes up with as their platform, or LNER, they can plug into the central infrastructure for tap and go. And so Traxys, that could turn into a really nice revenue stream for Traxys in the medium term. And really, you're just paying nothing for that right now. So, you know, lots of interesting components to that business. But it's a value situation.
Yeah, good. Okay, another value situation. We've got Vicky. She's asking about GB Group, which is an expert in all things identification to stop sort of like, you know, cyber crime and this sort of stuff, plus location. Shares were a darling during the lockdowns. They made a big acquisition, I think, into the States, which has been a bit troublesome, hasn't grown as fast as they were anticipating. Shares have stabilized, but they're right in that value territory again.
Yes, and I'd say the hard thing to weigh up with GB Group is the global technology for what they do. How is it evolving? And what are the dangers of us being a bit blindsided by something new coming along? But the important thing to remember about them is, you know, they are pretty much the biggest in their market, in a lot of their markets. So they're a very important player. You know, one thing that the points they made, I think quite potently really last year, was that most of their competition makes no money or is loss-making. So they're not only the number one player in their key markets, but they're also the only one that actually makes money in a decent way. Most of the others are PE-backed. And so what are they going to do? You know, at some point, will a PE company come along and say, well, actually, I need to make sense of these acquisitions and they're not making any money? If we put them together with GB Group, we've got an entity that becomes even more the biggest in the world and it starts making cash and we can cut costs. So, you know, we know that they almost got bought a couple of years ago and they fell away because they couldn't agree on price. Prices, you know, actually the PE company did the right thing to walk away. But you've got a very strategic key position in these big identity and security markets, fraud detection and ID, online ID proof.
Yeah.
You know, these are significant markets. Interesting that they had a lot of dependence on crypto when you had all the kind of the mania around crypto wallets, and you used to get sort of 10 emails a day trying to persuade you to set up some new crypto thing. They all needed identity, and that was a bit of a boom. Yeah. You know, that sort of faded a bit and really gone away, actually. So it's a tiny, tiny part of the business now. And so that created a bit of a headwind. I'd say the acquisition they made in the US was strategic, and they bought very good technology. And that's worth remembering. So it's technologically, GB Group's pretty rich, but they just overpaid for it hugely. Yeah. That's the problem. So it left their balance sheet geared and, you know, it weakened their position. But enough time has gone by that the balance sheet's re-strengthened and, you know, it's less of an issue now. They've kind of digested it. And, you know, I was getting excited really about this business maybe a year ago, thinking when you look at the product roadmap for the business, they're starting to build products where they can develop a network effect using their customers' own data. So they can basically say, well, if you, the customer, want to join this product, we can start sharing with you the frauds we've already picked up from other customers. Yes. As long as you're willing to do the same for these customers over here. So then you actually just improve the accuracy and predictions that your system's making. But you also start to build a very significant barrier to entry. And that product's been launched, and you know, I still think that is one of the most promising things about GB Group. Mm. But we've yet to see that translate into earnings growth. But actually, you know, if you like to look under the bonnet and say, well, actually, is this business improving? What's its potential in the medium term? And I'd say that's the place to really look and see, well, what's the progress of that product been? Is it getting customer acceptance? Because I think if that does get customer acceptance, that becomes a real asset for GB Group and a great product roadmap that will start to drive more, better valuation and more confidence in the growth of the business.
Yeah, no, that's another great point. I mean, and I think, you know, being in sort of like, you know, cybersecurity or ID, you know, identification, etc., you'd think with AI impersonating so many people to try and break people's sort of like systems particularly on the financial or whatever it is, then you thought they're right in that sort of sweet spot. And the thing which I can't quite understand is that sort of like optically wise, they're saying sort of 5% per annum organic growth top line. And I know you want to sort of like, you know, set the bar low and then beat and stuff like that. But you think over time it should be back to a double digit, but you know.
Yes, I mean, I agree with you. And that's the frustration every holder of this company has, is, you know, why is the growth not come through?
Yeah.
I guess it's about some parts of the business being weaker, some parts being stronger, and that sort of mixed shift that goes on when you're quite a big complex business, launching new products, putting some customers into the new product. So it's in a bit of a transitional phase, and the question is, how long does that last?
Mm. Good. Okay, well, let's move to one of the asset managers. We've got Catherine. She's asking about Mercer Asset Management.
Yeah. And yeah, the last set of results from Mercer were actually very well received and very strong. And they've been getting inflows into their core business, their core third-party funds. So this is VCT, EIS, and also government-backed innovation funds and some loan funds. And so they got to, I think, 1.8 billion of AUM, the last set of results. And yet the way Mercer is valued is, and this is one of the sort of things that the company needs to solve for, really, and they said they're going to do this over the next few years. It's really all about the company's balance sheet. So the company has, I think, net assets of, I might get these numbers slightly wrong, 170 million-ish, 160 million, say, of which 40 million is cash and 125, something like that, is unquoted investments on the balance sheet. So, of course, if you're an investor in this, how much do you believe of these unquoted investments? They can't sell them tomorrow. They can't sell them this year. When can they sell them? How much money are they going to get? As you know, the market is taking quite a penal view of these kind of investments and look at Molten Ventures valuation. Where you have earliest stage technology companies that are private on the balance sheet, how much do you discount to have enough of a comfort blanket to say, well, actually, I'm confident to say they're going to realize this much. And obviously, these companies are not ones you can really find out a huge amount about. You can look them up on Companies House, and they don't have great balance sheets on the whole. But what matters is what's going on in the business and how, have they got great growth trajectories? Well, you can't see that because most of them don't publish turnover numbers. So it's a little bit opaque. And there's been a bit of an absence of sales in that portfolio. And yet the company is still investing in that portfolio and have said, I think they're going to invest another £10 million in it. So some of your cash goes into that. The company is generating cash, which is great. So really the third-party funds business is getting a bit lost in all of this. And yeah, actually, as an investor, that's a bit I'm interested in and want to see them really grow. And I think most investors would want to see them shrink the balance sheet so that it becomes about valuing a fund management company rather than a load of private companies about which we know very little or comparatively little. And as the business makes that transition, it should be able to generate quite a lot of value. And I think net tangible asset per share is something like 44p. So if you can realize, let's say you could just realize 32p of that, which is the current share price, then you're getting the fund management company for nothing. And actually, this is a pretty valuable fund management business, very high margin, very niche, closed-end funds, longevity of revenues. So I think, the strategy of the company is about revealing the value of the third-party funds business and de-emphasizing the balance sheet and raising capital out of realizing capital from these investments.
Yeah, no, it looks good. Okay, good. Well, it's just thanks very much. We've been going for about an hour. But before we sort of finish, I ask all my experts what the sort of like their sort of stock would be to put on your watch list for the next sort of 12 months as we look into to 2026.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to make the case for a company called Boku, which I think many of you probably know.
Yes.
I mean, this I think is one of the really true growth businesses in the UK market. And we're not overrun with these things. We have a really high sales growth rate that should last well into the future with a reasonable degree of predictability. This company is a payments business on the face of it. So they are managing the integration of all kinds of non-standard payments processes for the world's biggest digital vendors in the world. All of the biggest vendors use Boku for their international payments.
It's carrier billing, isn't it? Onto telco, onto...
Well, it was carrier billing. That was where they came from. But the last few years, this has shifted into mobile payment methods. And so effectively new payment methods. And also the most recent addition here is direct bank payments. Mm. So in India now, I understand there's direct bank payments are becoming incredibly popular and very quick. And you just tap your phone and you're just doing a direct bank transfer. But you know, suffice it to say, there's a myriad of new payment methods. And that's why the companies want Boku to be a one-stop shop, connect me in Indonesia to all of these payment methods, you know, connect me in XYZ, you know, whatever country you're talking about, and then also manage the treasury function for me so that you pay me in dollars. I don't want to be worried about all the returns and the currency transactions. You know, some countries have, I think it was Mexico I was looking at, if I'm wrong over that, have some, maybe it's Colombia, have very long protected returns period. So, you know, you buy your digital asset here, but you have a right to return it for 6 months. And if you return it, you return it in local currency. How's that all managed? And so Boku is beginning to solve a significant number of problems for these companies, and that increases barriers to entry. But even you can get to the growth trajectory for the company just by looking at the rollout of certain contracts they've already won, in particular a huge contract with Apple, which is for something like 45 countries or mobile payment methods. I think it's countries, and they've only done five anyway. So they've got a long way to go in terms of rolling out some of these contracts where they've already won the business, but there's a long rollout pathway ahead. And I suppose my only frustration with the company, or the big unknown about it, is to what degree will they let the margins rise? And the reason you say that is this is very, very high margin sales.
Yep.
But every time the sales go up, they say, well, we've got all this to invest in, we're a growth company, we want to develop new markets and so on. So their R&D spending goes up. And so this is purely discretionary on the management's part. And I think the management have now said they're going to let the margins rise from 30 to 40%. They could easily have said 50%. But that means they want to keep the spending on growth quite high, which doesn't mean the growth trajectory is lengthening. So, you know, optically, it's going to look expensive on PE ratios. And that's because, you know, this is a company which has managed its profits quite down in order to really spend aggressively on growth and developing all of these new opportunities. But I think we'll start to see that growth come through to earnings quite rapidly in the next 5 years. And so, yeah, I think it's just, I mean, you know, one thing to mention here is that to get the full LTIPs, the manager have LTIPs, which is not unusual. But what is unusual is that to get 100% of their LTIPs, the share price needs to go over £9.
Right. So, okay.
So that is telling you that they were expecting quite a lot of growth in this business. And they clearly, you know, they still get some LTIP if it goes over, I think, £5. Mm-hmm. But they get nothing if it stays here. So, you know, this management are expressing a lot of confidence in the business by setting out a kind of remuneration incentive like that.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks very much, Paul. Fascinating idea to finish on that people can have a look at. And very much look forward in touching base again in about 6 months' time. So thanks, Paul.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me on.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.